Okay.
Anybody get some more here?
There's some more here.
First, okay. I just want to apologize for being late. I take a bus which normally takes 4 hours, and this morning it took 2 hours, and I'm really sorry. They count the demonstration budget. 40 minutes. Okay. All right, so, and the second apology might be for, well, good, if there are enough, that's fine. And the third apology, if I'm a little bit unbalanced, is because I generally come in early in order to make sure that I prepare myself and write on the board anything that I want to write, and obviously because I came late, I really won't be able to do all of that. No, that's okay. Let me also mention, by the way, that I had run into an old friend of mine by the name of Tom Soto, who is, in my opinion, certainly one of the foremost Marxists in the country. He had been active in Workers' World Party, in high up in leadership. He had been away for about a year and a half in Switzerland and in Germany and France, including East Germany, by the way. And I told him I would meet him here early at in the lunchroom, and I stopped there before I came here, and he wasn't there. So if he comes, it'll be good for you, because he has retained many of the ideas that I have not kept, as he has. So if he comes in, if he does find us and he comes in, that'll be a tremendous benefit to you. My goal was to tell you something that has meaning. I regard you all not only as intelligent, but also very experienced, very sophisticated, some of you with more experience than I have in many areas of life, and I really want to give you something, and I want it to be something that's worthy of you. That was another reason that I invited Tom, in case I was insufficient. Okay, now on this paper that I have given you, which speaks about theses and antitheses, it's important to understand that Marxism cannot be understood, and I had intended to sing a little song to you. Maybe I will. I'll sing you one, oh, red fly the banners, oh, why is your one, oh, one for the workers' unity that evermore shall be so. I'll sing you two, oh, red fly the banners, oh, what is your two, oh, two to the opposites, interpenetrating, oh, one for the workers' unity that evermore shall be so. The point is that Marxism cannot be thought of as itself. It can only really be understood as an antithesis to capitalism. I have, in this material that I prepared, I put down some of the elements that are involved in capitalism, and as I go along, perhaps I'll write some things on the board and to illustrate various points. For example, now, this was René Descartes, who was a very famous French mathematician who made many contributions in the field of mathematics, was trying to figure out how he could prove that he exists. And he was trying to figure this out during a time that capitalism was becoming dominant in France. And how shall he do it? Well, the fact that he eats, he sleeps, he goes to the bathroom, was not sufficient proof. The only thing that he could come up with was, well, I'm thinking about it. That's proof of my existence. And this is one of the basic elements that I put down in this thesis, antithesis. The top line that I have is that ideas are primary. In Marxism, matter is primary. And this too has grown out of a tremendous philosophical line of thought. The one that antedated Marx was Hegel, as I'm sure you're all aware. And Marx developed what was called the dialectic, the thesis, the antithesis, and then the synthesis. And in capitalism, the philosophical position is that ideas are primary. Even Hegel himself, in the end, came up with the fact that religion is primary. He turned ultimately to religion in Germany and ultimately to the state. And even so, in religion, there is the fact that there was the idea of creation before creation. Of course, that's what many people regard as God. And that preceded the existence. The position that Marx takes is materialism, that matter is primary, that the only reason that a person can think is because there is physical matter, the brain, that functions, whose function is to produce thought. In capitalism, there is the idea of free will, and this too has a religious base, the idea that there is good and evil and we are free to choose. In fact, incidentally, the whole idea of the right and the left has a religious intellectual basis. It has a basis in the idea that those who are good and accept God stand on the right hand of God. This was an idea that existed for centuries. And those who wanted to reject religion because the oppression that many people believed existed was based ultimately on a religious idea or the existence of religion. This is the intellectual currents in Europe. And they said, well, they stand on the right hand of God. We stand on the left hand of God as anti-God. And this is where the whole idea of right and left in politics comes from. That's where it really began, in this relationship to religion and to God. Now, also, under capitalism, consciousness determines existence. This is the idea that many people say that, well, if you just think it so, you can make it so. If you just determine to push in the direction of success or wealth or whatever it is that your goal is, then you will achieve it by the determination that you have. There is a lot, of course, to be said to this, and Marxism does not deny the power of the individual. In fact, one of the quotes that Marx made was, when an idea grips the masses, it becomes a material force. That itself, that an idea can be translated into a material force and can produce its realization in reality. This is so. But the point that Marx makes, and this, by the way, is in the second page, we turn to the second page. This second page is a photocopy of one of the pages in the preface to the Critique of Political Economy by Marx. And this is perhaps the most famous one-page summary of Marx's thinking. And I drew a line at the sentence that I wanted to call your attention to on the left-hand side. And it says, in the social production of their existence, men inevitably, are you all with me?
On the
left-hand side. It's the preface to the Critique of Political Economy, whatever that is.
Page three. All the way down.
No, it's not underlined. There's just a little line on the left. All right, follow me. In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations which are independent of their will, namely relations of production appropriate to a given stage in the development of their material forces of production. Okay, and he continues, the totality of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure, and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness. All of our consciousness grows out of the level of production and where we stand, by the way, in the relations of production. That the consciousness of the wealthy, the capitalists, if you will, is different from the consciousness of the workers, the oppressed, if you will. At any rate, and some of this I'm simply going to refer to, and at your leisure, you can look this over to get an idea of Marxist thinking. All right, and this is a point that I make here about consciousness as determined by our existence. Our consciousness, our awareness grows out of our experiences, out of our lives themselves. Okay, now, the next point, mankind evolves through historical accident. Biologically, even so, there is, I think, a widely held belief that because of the opposable thumb that man has, or our species have, that we have been able to develop into tool-making animals. And in that interconnected process, the making of the tool, the experiencing the making of the tool, the internalization of that experience, interpreting it for ourselves and understanding it, and through that dialectical interaction, opposites interpenetrating, we have evolved into the species that we have become. Okay, now, but further, what Marxism says is that in the process of this evolution, and it started when man was able to produce more than he could immediately consume, almost all animals consume what they kill, predatory animals, which is what we are. They consume what they kill, and if they cannot consume it, they have no way of preserving it. What happens is that jackals or foxes or vultures or different species come and they finish off whatever the predator has killed. But when agriculture evolved and women apparently were the force that created the agricultural evolution, development in our species, simply because man was the hunter, women in staying home learned the fact that they could produce, by planting seeds, food that could feed themselves and the group. And when there was a surplus, more than could be immediately consumed, a struggle evolved over who was going to control that surplus. And in the course of that struggle, classes evolved and the state came to being. Marx calls the state the agent of the ruling class. And when that state was evolved, ostensibly above the conflict between the groups, those that wanted to consume it because of need and those that wanted to control it because in one way or another it would be profitable, a state came into being as supposedly above the conflict and arbitrates the dispute. But in reality, it functions for those who have a certain amount of power. At a certain point, it may simply have been physical power. But involved, but as a social organization evolved, it became power through the organization. Okay, and then in terms of economics, there are some of the differences. And at the bottom of the page, I put down a couple of quotes that I wanted to call your attention to. One by Marx, and I had the, I imagine it was good fortune to have visited Marx's grave in Highgate Cemetery in London. And the quote that's engraved there, chiseled in stone, if you will, is the one that I put down here. Philosophers heretofore have interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And that's a quote from Marx. And there is another quote, and this one is even before Marx. In 1776, aside from the American Revolution, Adam Smith published his Wealth of Nations. And in the Wealth of Nations, this is what he said. Civil government, and this speaks to the point that I was just talking about, civil government, so far as it is instituted for the security of property, is in reality instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all. Adam Smith, not Karl Marx, Adam Smith. And of course, in the field of economics, Lenin said that there were three main sources that Marx synthesized. One was German philosophy. The other was and perhaps as great as an analyst of capitalism, Marx was, he built on the theories of Adam Smith and David Ricardo. Ricardo, by the way, who was a socialist. These were two. And the third one of the seminal events in the history of Europe, and a book recently has come out about it, opposing the French Revolution. But one of these seminal events in the history of Europe was, in fact, the French Revolution. This had such an impact on the thinking of all of the leading thinkers in Europe, if you will, particularly Hegel, by the way, and also in France itself, many of the leaders of the revolution felt that what has to be changed is the distribution of the social product. There must be a more equitable distribution of the social product. There were quite a few leaders, and it's not an accident in the main slogan of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and that equality speaks to the point of equality in the distribution of the social product. Liberty, equality, fraternity. So these were the three main intellectual and social currents that Marx synthesized and that Marxism itself grew out of. All right. Okay. These, as I said, are points that I simply wrote down. And you can look at them. You'll have time, or in the course of the discussion, some of you may refer to some of these points, and that will bring out some other points. But I want to call your attention to the next page. Just turn one page over. In one of the chapters of Capital, Marx spoke about where capital itself comes from, the genesis of capital. And in all of the pages, he speaks about how the capitalists, under the aegis of the state, stole property not only from the farmers, but also from common land. In England, and for those of you who remember story of Robin Hood, you know that one of the reasons that Robin Hood was under attack was because he was shooting deer in the king's forest. Now, it was all called the king's land, but this was recognized as common land. And part of the myth behind Robin Hood is it's not so much that he was stealing deer, but that the king, or the evolving capitalist class, was stealing the forest itself. And that was a point behind the myth. And in this page, and in every page of this chapter, there's an excellent discussion about how capitalism itself, the capitalists themselves, stole the debt. And if you see any marks on any of these, it's just that when I read something, I read it with a pen in hand, and sometimes I make notes to myself, and this is just from my copy. But on the right-hand page, he quotes, by the way, a Price. I'll start on the left-hand page, the first full paragraph down. Let us hear for a moment a defender of enclosures. That enclosures was closing off the land so that it could be used for various purposes, mostly shepherding, for sheep. Which was the wool industry in England was an industry that even Chaucer referred to. I mean, from the 1300 on, wool and manufacturing, clothing manufacturing, cloth manufacturing became a major industry in England. In fact, England almost joined the South during the Civil War because the South was supplying it cotton. Almost joined the South in the American Civil War because that was the source of its raw materials. Okay, but anyway, let us hear for a moment the defender of enclosures and an opponent of Dr. Price. Quote, "Nor is it a consequence that there must be depopulation because men are not seen wasting their labor in the open field. If by converting the little farmers into a body of men who must work for others, more labor is produced, it is an advantage which the nation," and then Marx adds parenthetically, "to which of course the converted ones do not belong, it is an advantage which the nation should wish for, the produce being greater than when their joint labors are employed on one farm." Okay, and then they make so much about the sanctity of property, and Marx points out on the right-hand page that I've underlined, or put a bracket around, "the stoical peace of mind with which the political economist regards the most shameless violation of the, quote, sacred rights of property, end quote, and the grossest acts of violence to persons as soon as they are necessary to lay the foundations of capitalistic mode of production is shown by Eden, philanthropist, and Tory to boot. The whole series of thefts, outrages, and popular misery that accompany the forcible expropriation of the people from the last third of the 15th to the end of the 18th century merely lead him to the comfortable conclusion, quote, the due proportion between the arable land and pasture land had to be established," and so on. And so on and so on. And he talks about how the land that was being used by the farmers, what percentage of actual land it was, how the percentage was cut until the capitalists had whatever land they wanted. All right. Now, and again, as I said, at your leisure, look at these points, and I don't know whether or not you would want this to go into another time. The thought occurred to me because what I'm really presenting to you is a world view. And how does one present, you know, clearly a world view? It's a very difficult thing, and I'll tell you about a problem I had with it as I was trying to figure it out. But there are also, and turn to the third page where there's a little poem, What They Want. Turn to the third page.
Whose poem is this?
Charles Bukowski. Right. Okay. Now, we live in a culture, and this is not just the United States, but these are the, you know, we think we are Eurocentric. We simply are, and that's not only our history and our language, our culture, our ideas, but it's a culture with many tensions, many contradictions, many conflicts. And a term that Roz used when I said, well, that's fragmented thought, she said, we're all fragmented. And it's true. And we have such difficulty pulling ourselves together to focus. And our age has nothing to do with it. I mean, there are young people that are experiencing the same kinds of difficulty. It's because this is what our culture generates. There are such tremendous contradictory forces that we cannot internalize them in a coherent way, in a cogent way. And it's simply an impossibility. And what we look for in artists, at least what I would look for in artists, what many people look for in artists, is in fact a synthesizer of having deeper insight, deeper sensitivity, or whatever, and mastering one art form or another. And what they would do, what they have a responsibility, a social responsibility, if you will, and again, this is me speaking, and you have your own ideas, and I know it, and I have respect for them, but I'm just telling you how I understand things. But what an artist has a responsibility to do is to synthesize different social, intellectual, emotional, philosophical currents, bring them together, and express them through an art form, so that when we look at that work of art, yeah, I understand. Okay, but artists themselves are caught in these same forces. And Charles Bukowski wrote a poem about it. And if I may, I'll just go over it with you. Vallejo, writing about loneliness while starving to death. Van Gogh's ear, rejected by a whore. Rimbaud, running off to Africa to look for gold and finding an incurable case of syphilis. Beethoven gone deaf. Pound dragged through the streets in a cage. Chatterton taking rat poison. Hemingway's brains dropping into the orange juice. Pascal cutting his wrists in the bathtub. Artaud locked up with the mad. Dostoevsky stood up against the wall. Crane jumping into a boat propeller. Walker shot in the road by a Spanish troop. Berryman jumping off a bird. Burroughs shooting a white male. And so on and so on. I mean, his conclusion is, well, you know, it's just egomania. But this is what it generates. I was taking the bus and coming from Queens, and you know, the bus was simply stalled in traffic. And all along the Long Island Expressway, they have these big concrete walls, and on all of them, there is the graffiti. And there are these young people, you know, and they see somewhere in them, they know that everything is an expression of ego. Trump is an expression of ego. But the newspapers quote Trump and TV reporters cover him, and nobody covers them, and they want, I exist, they say. See, I can write something down here, and everybody has to look at it. And this is what it becomes, egos fighting egos, a war of each against all, a madness. And again, never lose sight of the fact that Marxism is an antithesis to capitalism. This is the whole point. Without understanding that connection, Marxism cannot really be understood. All right. I'll save the next one for later on. Now, I am very lucky to have an older sister who has wisdom and judgment, and I had some 6 weeks to think about this. And I was, you know, I spent time thinking about it. And I was thinking, well, how can I present a world view? You know, I could take major categories of life, the economic, the emotional, the intellectual, the moral, and so on, and say, well, it's this and this and this. But you know all that. How can I do it in a way that gives you something? And she said, well, personalize it. Okay. You know, she's smart. Okay, she knows you all well. So I said, okay. I didn't say, I said, okay, or I don't know, what is it? Okay. Okay. So I'm going to personalize it. I'm going to make it a little bit more personal. After all, how is it that I come to be here talking about Marxism? Let me tell you a little bit. When I was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 or 10, thereabouts, and I hope nothing, my sister doesn't like me, or she told me once, I should not say something about our family, but...
It's all right, sir.
But be careful.
Be careful.
I'll try. Okay. Our father was on welfare. Many people were. It's not a source of shame to me. It's not a source of shame to anybody. This is simply hard times. As Marxism, by the way, has fallen on hard times today. But that's another story. And my father, who was a man for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect, who I think was a better man than I am, who was a man of dignity and strength. But he had to explain to a young woman, who seemed no more than a girl to me, some problem that he was having. And he was born in Greece, and I spoke Greek in the house. And I happen to be around, and a lot of times when you're involved in something, you don't pay attention to the children around. But that has such an impact. And because he was embarrassed or humiliated, because as I saw it, he was stripped of his dignity, he retreated to a position that many foreign-born take today. He pretended he didn't understand English well enough to deal with what she was talking about. And you know, he's apologetic and defensive, and say, "I'm sorry, I don't understand. I don't speak English." But I knew, of course, he understood clearly what she was talking about. But this was his defense, and this was his humiliation, and this generated me and in me an anger for this young woman subjecting this good man to this kind of humiliation. And I wondered, why is it? You know, I used to go to the movies and see all these people in their night. She was seeing Fred Astaire dancing in his tuxedo, and it was great. But why is it that they have and we don't? Are we not deserving? Are we not good? Do we not try to be good? Are we not courteous, respectful, intelligent, moral? Why? And I never really was able to answer that question until late. But in the course of also my life, when, you know, millions of people were going through this, and the only thing that brought the United States out of the Depression was World War II, and as befits somebody who was born in the middle 20s, I went into the Navy. And when I was at the Navy, I was assigned to the hospital corps and a ship. And the ship that I was assigned to, USS Barnett, took troops on in England, American troops, and they were getting ready to go into the invasion of France. And I was young, I wasn't even 18. I enlisted when I was 17. It was, you know, a noble thing to do. Besides, I thought that I would look good in the uniform and girls would be attracted to me. But I saw these soldiers, and I was in the hospital corps, and first, they had to sleep in the hold of the ship, and they were not accustomed to it. And they had to carry these knapsacks, which were burdens. And they had to be in a place that they were totally unfamiliar with. And I saw how they would get sick, they would get seasick. And I felt very sorry for them. They were about my age. I really felt very sorry for them. And when I was up in sick bay, when it was time to go into the small boats to hit the beaches, there were some young men up there that were so terrified they were not able to control their bowels. Such terror, such fear, such awareness that they might be going to their death. And when they got into these boats, the weather that morning was terrible. It was very choppy, it was terrible. And they had to climb into these small boats. And they were held in these boats, circling around the ships for a couple of hours. And they were seasick, and they were throwing up on each other and on the boat. It was terrible. And then the boats went in, and many of them worked here. And the job of our ship was to bring the wounded back and take them back to England. And they brought wounded back, and I was up in sick bay. I was working. We were knee deep in blood, not knee deep, ankle deep. It's literally ankle deep in blood. And they talk about war now. But I was walking around. I was in the middle of something, I don't know. And you know, part of what I was doing was trying to be encouraging that, you know, somebody would be there to help these people, these men. Young men, and I had a conversation with a man whom maybe the whole world has forgotten, but I can never forget. I was in the middle of a conversation with a man from Ohio, a young man from Ohio who was married and had two children. And in the middle of our conversation, he died. And why did he die? And I looked at these people, and they were hacking off limbs, arms, legs, you know, throwing them around. It was really, it was like the MASH on TV. And you know, that's what it was on the ship, and that's, I was right there. And why are they doing these to these young men? What underlies this whole thing? What are all these people fighting about? I wonder. At any rate, after the war, I went to Hunter College, it's up in the Bronx, and one of the courses that I was in was an honors course, an English writing honors course, the second term. And our assignment was to write 1,000 words a week, and then we brought them to class, and some of them were read and discussed. They were analyzed not only for form, but also for content. And there was one guy in the class who seemed to see so much deeper than I did. He understood so much more than I did. How did he get to be so smart? And I you know, I used to study him. I would think about what he said, and I wanted to figure out the secret. Where do you come from? What's your, you know, how do you know all this? And it turned out, you know, I didn't learn this until much later, that he was a member of the Communist Party. And he had a whole bunch of friends who were members of the Communist Party, including Dr. Du Bois' son, who is now in Ghana and the caretaker of his library. And others. Norma Becker was also among them. She was very prominent during the anti-Vietnam period as the leader of the Fifth Avenue coalition. But they were all members of the Communist Party, and, you know, I used to go to luncheonette and have coffee with them or something like that, and they were working on it. And they started giving me material to read. I was not easy, by the way. I was taking a course in logic, and I thought, well, this is a false premise. This conclusion doesn't grow out of this premise. This is illogical. It's not a valid syllogism. They would give me stuff, and I'd give it back to them. But it was having its effect. And as I started to read, I began to understand why my father had the experience that he did. And when I read Lenin's essay on imperialism, I understood World War II, World War I, the Civil War. I understood, you know, oh, this is truth. I was in a search for truth, and I found it. I joined the Communist Party. Shortly after that, the Communists were under attack, and another war broke out in Asia. 50,000 men died there in North Korea, in Korea, not to mention how many Chinese or how many Koreans. There was that. And also during the 50s, there was a war going on in Vietnam that people were learning about. And Eisenhower went to Geneva in 1954, and they wrote an agreement where Eisenhower said that, well, we'll have an election. But he knew that Ho Chi Minh would have been elected president, so in 1956 they said, well, no more elections. So this was going on. There was a civil rights struggle. There was the anti-Vietnam struggle. All of these struggles. And I was active in the Communist Party. And until I decided that the Communist Party itself was too tied to the Soviet Union. And I decided, well, it is not really the Revolutionary Party. And the real Revolutionary Party is Workers' World. And Tom Soto, this is where I met Tom Soto, who I apparently either is not here or is lost or is in the lunchroom. And I'm, but at any rate, under the aegis of Workers' World Party, I went to Cuba in 1976 with the Vince Ramos Brigade. And I worked on housing for workers that connected to a factory. And the workers were going to live in that housing rent-free as part of their job. Also in the meantime, the building that I lived in wanted to organize a tenants association. I have very little awareness of an apartment or many things around me, physical things around me. I just never developed a keen awareness about that. But since they were trying to organize a tenants association, I felt a responsibility, a political responsibility, to make a contribution if I could, even to develop a class consciousness among the tenants as a class. And I went to a few meetings and I was elected president. Then an organization was going to come into the area, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which was started by Eleanor Holmes Norton in order to counter white flight. Many of you, I'm sure, remember the struggle around Left-Right City when Left-Right did not want to rent to Afro-Americans. And there was a court case and he was ordered to open up Left-Right City to the Afro-Americans. And he did it with such spite that many whites left. And there was concern in the City Commission on Human Rights that this be countered, that there be community organizers that will try to work for tenants' rights and in the process unify tenants of all ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, all ethnic groups. And there were bringing one into the community, and I applied for a job, and I got it, and I became an effective organizer simply because I was a revolutionary and committed to the struggle. And one of the buildings that I worked with, I encouraged the tenants to deduct because they didn't get the heat and hot water for a few days, which they did. They had enough confidence and trust in me to say that if I suggested something and gave them reasons for it that seemed reasonable, they did it. We took the landlord to court. We had a rent strike in that building. And the landlord himself was one of the better landlords. I mean, he was okay, really. In fact, we developed some kind of a conversation, dialogue. His name was, well, I don't know that his name makes any difference. His name is Herbert Hoffman. He's got some buildings here. And any time he wrote anything to the tenants, it was always on stationery that said, Office of the Undersigned. You know, such sleaze, they don't even put their names down, you know. So I wrote him a letter, which I sent to the Office of the Undersigned. And the reason I wrote this letter is because I told him that the tenant is always right. This, of course, is an ideological position. It's a class position. And we had discussions about different things. But anyway, I said, Dear Herbert, since I never compromised in working for the tenants, I felt, nor would I ever compromise, by the way, in their struggles with him. I didn't feel that I was compromising myself in writing to him. And I'd like to quote to you. Dear Herbert, since I have on several occasions said to you that the tenant is always right, I would, out of the friendly feelings I have for you, explain to you my reasons for saying it. My point of reference is Marx's distinction in the values that are given in any given commodity, in this case, an apartment. He distinguished between use value and exchange value. He developed this concept about what lies in a commodity. These two values, its use value and its exchange value. The terms are almost self-explanatory, with market value as a synonym for exchange value. The fact that a tenant uses the commodity infuses that commodity with life-giving properties, and that a landlord is primarily concerned with the profit he can make in exchanging the commodity diminishes its life-giving properties. The motive for the landlord is profit, exchange value. The motive for the tenant is use. In the unequal struggle between a tenant and his landlord, a tenant can best defend himself by uniting with his fellow tenants, thereby of necessity enlarging the social and human facets of his personality. In that same struggle, the landlord must consider his costs, fuel, labor, materials, etc. The landlord, by raising money considerations to his highest priority, diminishes the social and human facets of his personality. Since we, as a species, rely primarily on strengthening social and human ties, the behavior of the tenant is in keeping with the species' need, and the behavior of the landlord contributes, by fighting for secondary and tertiary values, to the destruction of the species. Since in the most general sense, morality is inseparably connected to the preservation of the species, the tenant, simply by virtue of his position, commands moral support and is therefore always right. And then in parentheses I put down, please give me more credit than to infer from anything I've said that I am unaware that some tenants are destructive. Even they, however, are victims. And we had a conversation about Einstein, and I say, also for your information, Albert Einstein on Lenin, and I quote, this is what Einstein said about Lenin: "I respect him as a man who has sacrificed himself completely and devoted all of his energy to establish social justice. I do not consider his methods practical, but one thing is certain, men of his caliber are the guardians and restorers of the human conscience." And that's from his quote, "The Man and His Thoughts" by Hilary Cuny, published in 1965, page 105. Okay. Now, what are the landlords going through, and what were they going through? This was during the period of the early 80s, when co-op conversion was the dominant thrust. I'll just take a little bit more time, and then we'll open the floor to the discussion. Too much time? I'm sorry. Okay, I'll cut it here. One last quote, if I just may, and then cut it after this. This is a brief one. When there was co-op conversion in the early 80s, I was getting copies of the Real Estate Weekly. This is for landlords, buying for landlords. And I just want to quote what the landlords were saying to each other about co-op conversion, just briefly. "An interesting phenomenon has made its mark on the New York real estate scene over the past several years with devastating effect. Buyers..."